This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Welcome to another edition of the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harold. Thanks so much for tuning in. You know, one of the things that makes this show a real hoot to do is the fact we have so many international listeners. I love getting their comments and their email, and wanted to read a few tonight before we get started. This one's from Roger in the UK. Here's an excerpt from his email. Hi, Jim. Just a quick note to say how much I enjoy your podcast. I always listen to it at the gym. Takes my mind off of the agony. Keep up the good work, Roger. Thanks for listening to us in the UK, and hopefully you'll tell your friends. This one's from Rhett in South Africa. He said, hey, Jim, I just wanted to say your show is fantastic. I never miss an episode. Have told all my friends here in South Africa about your show, and they love it too. Keep up the good work and would love to hear more on the UFO and alien topic. Best wishes, Rhett. And best wishes to you, Rhett. Thank you for listening, and thank you so much for telling your friends. Here's kind of a fun one. My name is Neil from Australia. I currently work as a security officer at a static site during the night. Therefore, I have 10 hours a night to listen to podcasts. Not a bad job, really, Neil says. He said, I would like to take this opportunity to thank you for a very interesting show. I've only recently been able to listen to all of your podcasts to date and was very impressed with your level of style and questioning. It's great to see an upsurge in interest and, more importantly, honest research into these topics. You keep up that work there at that security job. Keep that site safe and your iPod tuned in. Thanks so much for all of that. I mean, it's just very gratifying. We saw the iTunes reviews. We're moving up on the charts. This weekend, at one point, we were the number 13 audio podcast in the United States in the science category, ahead of podcasts from the New York Times and NPR. So you guys are making it happen. Please continue to submit those reviews and tell your friends, and we will move forward and move up the charts even further with your help. And now let's get to the interview. An interesting show with old friend Jeff Belanger. It really is my pleasure to welcome back an old friend of the show, Jeff Belanger. Jeff has recently written a book. It's called Who's Haunting the White House? The President's Mansion and the Ghosts Who Live There. And the spin on this one is that it's actually a book for kids, although it's good for kids, but I'm sure adults will enjoy it as well. Jeff, thanks so much for coming on the show tonight.
Hey, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
I wanted to start it off because I had my first question in mind, and I was talking to my daughter, Cassie Harold, who's read the book.
Oh, great.
And I said, why don't you come up with a question? And she stole my first question. How about that?
I'm gonna
give it to her and let her give you her question, and you can respond.
Mr. Belanger, I enjoyed your book, but I have a question. What made you interested in writing a book about haunted presidents in the White House?
That's a great question from Cassie. How old is Cassie?
She's 9 years old.
Oh, that's perfect. That's
yes,
right in the
yes,
age range.
Yes.
Great. Yeah, no, I've been interested in the White House for a long time. I wrote about it in my first book, The World's Most Haunted Places. I had a little chapter on the White House. And I think what's intrigued me, the more I've gotten into researching the paranormal, is one of the things I'm always looking for is really credible witnesses. When you talk about the White House, everybody who works there, I mean, mainly the employees, not so much the elected officials, but these folks are screened. You know, these folks have got security screening, psychological screening, drug testing. So when they say they see something, you can pretty much rule out drugs, hallucinations, you know, delusions, all that other stuff, because these people are around the president, they're around heads of state, things like that. So there's some built-in credibility when people there, you know, say something's going on. Plus, when you consider all the security and everything else, you know, nothing's supposed to happen in the building or on those grounds that isn't accounted for, planned, you know, in someone's clipboard and otherwise. And the other part of it is I'm a huge fan of history. And when you stand in the White House and you realize every single president of the United States stood where you're standing, it's a powerful experience. And then if you believe some of the accounts of people like past presidents and employees of the White House and staff and first families, some of those presidents might still be there. And I'm just completely intrigued that a building as famous, as well-known, and as historical as the White House has more than its share of ghostly legends, and just been hooked on researching that and finding that some of the presidents actually talked about it and even wrote about some of the ghosts of the White House.
You know, Jeff, I can understand how you would be gravitated to the story of the White House. I guess the question I would have is, why did you decide to do a child's book? I mean, you're one of the leading lecturers and resources for the paranormal out there. You have your great site at ghostvillage.com. You've been on multiple television shows, NPR, Coast to Coast AM. Why did you decide to kind of deviate and do a kid's book this time around?
My first love was writing for children, actually, in college. I had written a few children's stories. They never got published, although I still have hope that I'm going to revisit those one day. But I guess I've always fancied myself kind of a teacher. I've been coaching soccer. I coached soccer when I was in high school, when I was in college. And for the last 5 years, I coached a youth soccer team here in town. So I've always worked with kids in some capacity. And I also found that the more I was researching a lot of these haunts, you know, some of them are historic sites. And I'll tell you when I first got the idea, this was years ago. I was talking to one of the docents at Fort Calgary in Alberta, in Canada. And it's one of these historic sites. There's lots of them all over the world where it's a historic place where people, they give tours, and it's made to look and operate like a certain year, you know, like a, you know, 100 years ago. So people dress in period costumes, and they get a lot of school groups that come in to learn about the history of the location. And Fort Calgary has got a few ghostly legends attached to it. And one of the docents was telling me that they were just inundated by kids asking about the ghosts. And I thought about it, and I said, you know, this makes perfect sense. When did I start reading books by Brad Steiger and Hans Holzer? I was 10. I was 10 and 11 years old, and I was grabbing those books in the bookstore. And I said, well, you know, and I know some of the emails I get from young readers who are 10 years old reading my adult books. And I said, wow. So the docent at Fort Calgary told me, they said, you know, one day we just kind of relented and said, all right, instead of denying the ghosts, let's use them as kind of a carrot to dangle in front of the kids, saying, well, if you pay attention and you're good, at the end we'll tell you about the ghosts. And I thought, you know, one better would be to incorporate the ghosts into the tours, because if anyone who studies the paranormal knows, especially, you know, if you're looking into ghosts and legends and things like that, it can't be done. You can't study ghosts and hauntings without also studying history. It's impossible, because the history is what sets the stage for these ghosts. We need to go back in time. We need to know what took place in this location. You know, were there battles fought here? Did people die here? Who lived here? Who is famous? Who left a mark? Who might have some reason to hang around? You have to look back. And I thought, what an innovative way to teach history. Instead of facts and figures and dates and things like that, why not start with ghosts? You know, I took a mystery writing course in college, and I remember the teacher saying, when you write a mystery story, you have to write the ending first. You know, someone's dead. Now you go back, and you're plotting. You have to establish, you know, who might have done it, what their motives are, and then you put your twists in. And I said, wow, that's kind of like, you know, ghost hunting. We start at the end. There's a ghost. Now we have to go back and figure out who did it. And I thought, wow, what a great learning tool that would be. What a new way to teach history. And boy, you know, I didn't develop a love for history until I was an adult. And I think if I would have had middle school teachers that would have taught this way, man, I would have been hooked even earlier.
Well, it is interesting, because there's nothing more fascinating than, to me at least, than history, if it's well told and well studied and well written. And it was funny, as my daughter was reading this book, I thought, boy, and she was reading certain sections out loud, I said, he's being very sneaky about this. There's a lot of history in there.
That's right. I freely admit it. I am out to deceive children. Let me go on the record. I am going to trick you into learning something. You must go back, and you must get to know some of these figures if we're going to appreciate, you know, the ghosts and the legends of the White House. But to me, I mean, there's a saying I heard years ago that I think is something to live by. History is a damn good story. It just needs damn good telling. And it's so true. You know, it's the story's already there. It's up to us to tell it in an innovative way. We don't have to embellish it. We don't have to make it up. But I think ghosts are an amazing learning tool that we can use today, and that was part of the goal.
Why do you think the White House is such a place that's so chock full of not only history but ghost stories?
I think any location that's full of important history, that's full of tragedy, that's full of powerful emotions, it's going to leave a mark on that location. A classic example is a place like Gettysburg. You know, 51,000 dead or wounded in 3 days. oh my God. You know, anyone who's ever stood there, I mean, I'm not talking about being psychic or anything like that, but when you stand where 51,000 were dead or wounded in just 3 days, you drink that in. It's a very powerful experience because you know what took place there. And I think the White House has that power. I've heard presidents, I remember President Bush the senior talking about one of his early days in office where you sit in there and he said how the Oval Office has power, but I would say the whole building has power. You sit there and you realize where you're sitting and who's come before you. And I remember him talking about he had to make some kind of tough decision about sending troops into harm's way and kind of a minor military confrontation compared to some of the things we've been involved with since. But he sat there struggling, and he thought about Abraham Lincoln and what he had to go through and how, you know, no president, you cannot make an argument for any other president having a harder time in office than Abraham Lincoln. Nobody, you know, had it tougher than Lincoln. When you have a nation at war with itself, a civil war, tens of thousands of your own people dying on your own soil every single day, you know, for years, that was as bad as it ever got. And I think presidents draw on that. I think presidents sit down and they look at the tough decisions they have to make, and they think about all those decisions made before them in that very building, and that leaves a mark. And I think we're all, you know, if you want to call it a psychic impression, and we're all a bit sensitive to it, and when you're in the context of the location, I think you pick up on it. And I think that's why so many witnesses have reported, you know, some kind of events from the past, whether it be presidents still lurking the halls, first family members, you know, things like that. It's a place that holds memories.
It's interesting. You talked about one of the reasons, not only the historical side, but the fact that the witnesses are so credible. Can you tell us about some of the various folks that we might know who have seen ghosts and experienced phenomena at the White House?
Sure, Harry S. Truman. How's that?
Pretty good.
President Harry S. Truman referenced the ghosts many times in his writing. He once wrote in a letter to his wife, "Sure as shooting, this place is haunted." And he told one story in writing where he was alone in the White House. His family had gone home for a break, and so he was alone sleeping upstairs. And he said in the middle of the night he heard a door open, and he was sure someone was out there. So he got up and looked. No one was there. Went back to bed. He heard it again. He goes downstairs, and where there's a Secret Service agent. You have to remember now, even back in Truman's time, which really wasn't all that long ago, nobody goes upstairs without permission of the first family. That's still true today. I mean, the upper portions, the second and third floor of the White House, are the first family residence. That's where they live. And as opulent and beautiful and expensive as that place is, I think most of us would never, ever, ever want to live there, considering you're more or less in a fishbowl.
You're in a cage of sorts.
You're right, yeah. You're in a very nice cage. But Truman heard something, and so he goes downstairs, finds the Secret Service agent on duty, as he's supposed to be, and said, you know, did you just come upstairs for something? And the agent reported, no, absolutely not. Everything is A-OK down here. And that's what he said, you know, you better come get me. You know, he was hearing creaks and moans and all kinds of other things, and he referenced the ghost several times. Ronald Reagan once told reporters, in kind of an off-the-cuff interview, but enough that it made it into print, that his dog would get in front of the Lincoln bedroom and bark wildly and never go in, always was uncomfortable going there. One of the chief ushers of the White House, and there's only been 9 in the history of the building, the chief usher is the boss of the building. And that's the person that everybody reports to. About 100 employees work for the White House. Doesn't matter who's president. Democrats, Republicans, makes no difference. These are the cleaning crew, the foreman, the groundskeepers, the chefs, all those folks that serve regardless of which political party's in power. And this gentleman I talked to, Gary Walters, had served every single president since Nixon. And so if you think about it, this guy spent more time in that White House than any president ever, because a president can only serve 8 years. And he was there from 67 to 2007, you know, weekends, nights, serving, you know, various functions day in, day out. And as I'm sure you know, people who are most likely to experience something are people who live and work in a location. They just put in more time. It's nothing more than that. The odds are just with them. You might visit for an hour or two and see something. It's possible, but you know, the odds aren't with you. And so he talked about how, you know, granted this was kind of a slight experience, but he was walking through the hall one night, and a whoosh of air comes by and it slams one of these giant metal doors shut, one of these doors that are on magnets that are held open. And he was with a police officer who was making the rounds with him. And they both looked around and said, you know, what was that? And they check all the doors, looking if someone created some kind of vacuum that would have, you know, been strong enough to pull that door shut. And they found absolutely nothing. So it's one of those things where he says, you know, I'm not ready to make the leap to a ghost, but at the same time, I can't explain it. Other staff members, there's a foreman who works there who was going upstairs one morning to turn on the lights, which was part of his duties. And he said he was coming around the corner and looking down the hallway, and right in front of the Lincoln bedroom, he sees Abraham Lincoln sitting there with his legs crossed, looked at him, and then disappeared. And you say, wow, you know, how do you explain that one? That's not just a rush of air. And the thing about Lincoln, you know, you have to remember, if you're standing in a graveyard or a battlefield and you see someone hundreds of yards away walking, you might say, wow, I wonder if that's a ghost. But you don't know, because it could just be a living person out for a stroll.
Sure.
But Lincoln, we know what he looks like. He's on the $5 bill. We see his ID all the time. You know, we see his face. You know, every time you pull out a fiver for your Happy Meals. You know, I mean, so you look and you go, nope, that's not someone just walking by. That's Abraham Lincoln, one of the most recognizable figures in American history. You know, very distinct jawline and beard and the whole thing, and you know, he's just one of the many people that have reported encountering Lincoln. And so you know, these witnesses go on and on. And when I was there a few years ago, when I was working on the book, I took the standard tour at first before I got to interview some of the staff. And I was walking around, and there's a Secret Service agent in every room as you're walking around. And they know everything about the building, everything about the room. You can point to a piece of furniture. I mean, it was incredible. They said, oh, that came from, you know, Chesapeake, Virginia in 1840. It was built by a craftsman there named, you know, John Smith. That painting is of so-and-so, painted by this person. That bust came in. This carpet was brought in 1994 by the Clintons. They thought the old one was getting ratty. And you go, wow. They just know everything. And so I said, well, what do you know about the ghosts here? And they said, sir, we understand Abraham Lincoln said to be in and around the Lincoln bedroom upstairs, and a British redcoat's been seen near the North Portico. And I looked at him and I said,
matter of fact.
Yeah, I said, you said that in the same tone of voice you talked about the rug and the bust and the painting and the chair. And I said, is this some kind of like federal recognition of ghosts or something? And he just kind of smiled, and, you know, that was kind of the end of our discussion. But an enlightening one at that. So they know about it. Everyone there knows about it. Hillary Clinton was asked about it on the Rosie O'Donnell show a few years ago. And she said, you know, when they were still in office, she said, yeah, you know, it can be a creepy place. So...
It's you know, that's fascinating that somebody that recent, that is obviously known by all, would admit to something like that. That's quite fascinating.
Especially someone who had political aspirations at the time. Still does. Yeah, still does. Obviously, yeah, they didn't go away, but you know, still has political aspirations. Yeah, that's why I'm so curious. And you know, I don't want to be so egocentric as to think that, you know, the book's going to get the attention of the President of the United States. But if it does land on his desk, the new kid's book, you know, I mean, he doesn't have much to lose, right? Call me, George. Call me. I know you listen to Jim's Paranormal Podcast each week.
That's right. That's right.
I know you're hearing this. Call me. I want to come down.
That's right. We will we'll arrange a call anytime, Mr. President. It's your convenience.
Right.
We'll clear the schedule and we'll have a three-way call with you and Jeff, and you can identify the reality of ghosts and
yeah.
Put the presidential seal on it.
How about live from the White House? We can do better than a call.
Yeah, that's true. That's an excellent idea. Well, you talked about some of the various presidents, but I think anytime you talk about mysticism and presidents, and you've mentioned him at least half a dozen times, Abraham Lincoln, the most mystic of all of our presidents. Talk a little bit about Lincoln during his life and afterwards.
Yeah, Lincoln was an incredible president. Not only did he have the toughest time in office for a number of reasons. Not only, you know, was he dealing with a nation at war with itself, but he lost his son. His son died in the White House while he was serving as president, his young son Willie, and that just broke him up. You know, he had precognitive dreams, he believed, about seeing his own death, where he was attending a funeral, and he saw that it was a state funeral, and he walked up and he asked the soldier, you know, what's going on? And they said, it's, you know, someone died. And they said it was the president, sir. And he took that as a sign that he would not survive his second term in office.
And didn't he see his double reflection in a mirror or something along those lines?
Right. Yeah, he did reference at one time seeing almost like his double in a mirror, where he saw his reflection, but he also saw a paler version of it. And he thought that might have been, looking back now, we could say that was a sign of something to come at the time, you know, who knows. But he and his wife, especially his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln, were holding seances in the White House after Willie died. Mary Todd, they were both broken up, but Mary Todd really wanted to reach out and try to contact him. And we know that President Lincoln attended at least one of those seances because he paid a bit of a political price for it. I mean, it made it in some of the papers saying, look at what this crazy president is doing. He's talking to spiritualists and attending seances in the White House. So he went to at least one. Maybe he went to others and was a little more secretive about it, but we do know that he went to at least one. Trying to make contact. The first report of a ghost in the White House that I could find anyway was Mary Todd Lincoln writing in a letter to her sister saying that at night Willie is coming to her bed, the end of her bed, and he's there visiting her, and she took great comfort that he was still around. Now that was the first report. Now you could say Mary Todd Lincoln was a distraught mother who might have been dreaming or hallucinating or wishful thinking or whatever, and I accept that. But what's interesting is that later on down the line, in the first couple years of the 1900s, a military aide named Archibald Butt was writing published a book of his memoirs, and he had mentioned going to the White House and talked about how some of the servants were spooked by the ghost of a little boy who lived there. Now, they didn't even mention Willie Lincoln. The name never came up, just that a little boy's ghost was seen in the White House, and Archibald Butt said that this might be the only thing to make this building any more interesting than it already is that it might also be haunted. So a little boy's ghost, you know, comes up again a few decades after the Lincolns move out. Really, a fascinating president. I know he's been called, you know, the psychic president and the mystic president and all that other stuff. And, you know, I certainly think he was somewhat open to those kinds of things. But, you know, really, he had the toughest time in office as well.
Well, after this break, we're going to talk to Jeff Belanger more about who's haunting the White House, the president's mansion, and the ghosts who live there. Right after this break on the Paranormal Podcast. Hey, everyone. I just wanted to say thanks again so much for the great iTunes reviews. We are so appreciative of those. We've consistently been in the top 25 of podcasts in our category, whether it's just general podcasts or audio podcasts. We've actually surpassed that Skeptical Podcast on reviews just by a little bit. So please keep them coming. We'd love to get to at least 100 reviews, if not more. We want to get the attention of the iTunes folks and of folks out there who love podcasts but may not be aware of the Paranormal Podcast. So thanks again. We really appreciate it. And now this word from our announcer.
Back to the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harold.
Back on the Paranormal Podcast, and tonight we're exploring, and the timing couldn't be better, actually, as we're sitting here recording, and in the next few moments, a presidential debate will start. We're headed right towards Halloween, and also we're headed right towards a presidential election now. Jeff, I'm sure all of this timing is total coincidence, isn't it?
Total coincidence. The book was written 2.5 years ago, and, it was turned in, and, Sterling decided that they wanted to kind of capitalize on the whole season and get it out right now. So it's interesting. We're getting a lot of great calls from various media places that want to talk about, you know, whoever wins the next election is going to be moving their family into a haunted building. So that's been a lot of fun. But hey, it's October. It's my busy season, and then November comes and people leave me alone until the following October, so that's okay. We'll take it.
Well, thank you for taking time in your busy schedule to talk with us tonight, because I know your schedule's got to be jam-packed.
No, my pleasure.
We were talking during the break about some of the different stories, and one that you really wanted to talk a little bit about was that of Abigail Adams and her relation to this book.
Yeah, Abigail Adams was the second First Lady of the United States, wife of John Adams, And they were the Adamses were the first to actually move in and live in the White House. George Washington was there for the laying of the cornerstone, certainly approved the plans, oversaw a lot of the construction, but died before it was complete. And so he never got to spend a night in there. But the John and Abigail moved into the White House. And what people forget is that, you know, here's this president's mansion, this beautiful big building, and there's no furniture. There was no money for that. And the Adamses had a house back in Braintree, Massachusetts. That was their home. That's where they planned to move as soon as John Adams was finished being president. That was going to remain their home. And they certainly weren't going to pay to furnish this big building themselves. They couldn't afford it. So you had completely empty rooms with nothing in it. And it was drafty and cold. You only had fireplaces for heat. So unless you were really close, you know, and if you have a really big room, even a roaring fire, you're going to have to be close to the fire. You get, you know, 8-10 feet away, you might not even feel the heat at all. So you have this drafty, cold building. You know, some of the plaster was still wet when they moved in. And Abigail Adams looked at the giant east room that was had nothing in it and figured, what the heck, and hung her laundry there. That's, you know, she was going to make use of the space. Why not? And it's interesting that over time, there's been a few reports of seeing a woman hanging laundry in the East Room that we believe would be Abigail Adams, you know, who might be pleased that finally there's nice furniture in there today.
Well, it's just remarkable because, again, you've interjected some history into this story. And I think that's so valuable to young people. And for that matter, us as adults could have a lot to learn about the history of the White House. You also had a story about a mysterious redcoat. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, this is something that a lot of people, I don't think, know in American history. During the War of 1812, the British sacked Washington, D.C. They really sacked the city. They came in, they ate the dinner that was on the table. The first family barely escaped with their lives, and they burned the building down. They burned the White House to the ground. The only thing that was left was the strong, you know, stone outer shell, but otherwise it was gutted by fire. And one of the prominent figures today is a British redcoat seen, you know, possibly holding a torch walking the grounds that we believe is some kind of leftover from that battle. And what's interesting too, and talk about a sense of history, there's two spots on the White House that they never paint white. There's a window near the North Portico, and on the Truman balcony on the back, there's a on the southern side, there's a little spot under the window, you know, just a couple of square feet each, where they've never painted it since 1812 and since 1814, rather, when the city was sacked, and it still shows the burn marks that came through the window, and they don't paint it as a reminder of what happened. You know, America let its guard down, and the city was burned down for it, and so kind of an interesting little tidbit there, and you know, it would almost serve to have that ghost lingering to remind us. If the charred windows aren't enough, how about the you know, the red coat with a torch that might still be looking to take care of that building once again?
What surprised you most in doing this book?
I think what surprised me was that the cooperation I got at the federal level. You know, when I first called and I said, you know, I want to do a book on the White House and you know, write about some of the ghosts, and they said, yeah, we're not too interested in that. And I said, no, we're going to use ghosts as a way to teach history. And they said, you know, go on, tell us more. And then how forthcoming people were, people who work there that just said, hey, this is what happened. It is what it is. And I just thought that was wonderful. And then what surprised me, too, is that I always wondered, you know, some of these people who have been there for decades, some of the butlers there are third generation White House employees. You know, their dads worked there, their grandfathers worked there. You know, they go way back. And I said to Gary Walters, the chief usher, and I said, you know, this was kind of an aside, you know, not really for the book, but I said, I have to believe that you have not voted for the winner in every election, meaning the person you cast the vote for since 1967 was not necessarily the person who won, and you got to bring that SOB coffee. You know, and even if you did vote for someone who won, no president makes everybody happy all of the time. You know,
sure.
Every president's going to do something. Even if you voted for that president, they're going to do something that you really, really have trouble with. And how do you look them in the eye and say, "Wow, you know, I can't believe you just did that." And the answer I got really blew me away, and it really changed my perspective. He said, "You know, we don't serve the president. We serve the presidency. And there's a difference. And I never really thought about that. You know, what he does is he views, like, you know, putting the right meals together when foreign heads of state are visiting and things like that. He views that as serving his country. You know, when the Russian premier comes over, he can make sure that there's good food that he's going to like, that there's, you know, that a meal that'll be pleasing to him. And so when the doors close, the president and the premier can, you know, have a meeting of the minds. And I realized, wow, you know, no Secret Service agent would ever take a bullet for George Bush or for Bill Clinton or for any president. They take a bullet for the presidency, this concept, this pinnacle of America. That's what they take the bullet for. And that's, therein lies the difference. I think that was probably the most enlightening part of the discussion.
And I think that's it's a great point now that we're in the election season. And that's something that I think America should be very proud of, is the, regardless of which way an election goes, that there is a peaceful transition of power. You know, we have our internal squabbles, but we've managed to do it pretty well for over 200 years. And it does mean a lot. And I think it's a very good point.
Yeah, no, and you know what else too? I also learned that the White House is only empty for really about an 8-hour period. It's incredible when they move one first family out and the other first family in. It's 4 hours to get the first family out and 4 hours to get the new first family in. It's incredible how they do things there. The sense of you know, I think the sense of history and tradition are matched only by our neighbors in Britain, who carry it, I think, even a step further. But just what a place! And for people, you know, it doesn't matter who's president or who you voted for or who you're angry at. If you ever get the opportunity to go, it's so well worth your time to stand in the White House and drink that in.
And I just got this visual as you were talking with George W. Bush with some moving boxes and a Sharpie. But anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah. They all say Texas.
Crawford, Texas.
Yeah, right.
Let me ask you this. You know, you've just completed this book. I think this is going to be a great boon to your already very high stature. What's going on now at ghostvillage.com, and what else, what exciting projects do you have coming up in the future?
Well, we do have something pretty interesting that we just launched a couple of weeks ago, which is obviously timing well with this book as well. We just launched kids.ghostvillage.com. And what that is it's a resource for kids, parents, and educators on how to talk about ghosts. It's for educators on how to use ghosts in the classroom, not just in teaching history, but also in you know, teaching things like storytelling and creative writing. It's an opportunity for parents to learn how they can talk about ghosts with their kids if they believe they might be dealing with a haunting. So there's guidelines there depending on the age of your child. And, of course, all of this is subject to your own judgment, you know, judging how mature you believe your child is on how to deal with this. So if you believe your house is haunted, your child might be frightened, you know, how do you talk about that with your kids? We've put together a great advisory board. We've got a psychologist, PhD, who works with children exclusively, also happens to be my sister, but certainly a great help. We've got educators. We've got children's book authors, you know, who all help put this, help oversee this content and offer direction on where we should go. And it's going to be a resource where we're going to offer author interviews with various children's book authors who are writing about ghosts and the paranormal. And you know, a way to incorporate ghost hunting with your kids as an educational endeavor, a family endeavor, how to do it safely, how to make sense, and also a place for kids to submit their reports of some of their own investigations.
Well, that sounds extremely interesting. I will ask this for a moment as devil's advocate.
Mm-hmm.
Have you had anybody comment, or is there a concern that this might be pushing children towards a certain belief system or indoctrinating children? Just trying to think of the devil's advocate side.
Yeah,
what has been your response to that?
Yeah, great question. And one of the two things that I put down from day one is that, number one, we're going to remain religiously neutral, that we're not going to endorse any belief system, that, you know, it's up to parents to bring their belief system into this. The reality is kids are interested in this subject. I was interested as a kid, and I was raised Catholic. And
yeah, me too.
I don't believe that they conflict, personally. I haven't been convinced that they conflict, but other parents may feel differently, and that is absolutely their prerogative to step in and say, this is what we believe, this is what we don't believe. All we're talking about is what kids are interested in, haunted legends, ghosts, and the other thing that absolutely we're staying away from is the idea of psychic kids, you know, psychic development in children, all of that stuff, whether you want to call it star kids or indigo children, all of those things, we are leaving that out of it as well. Not that I don't think there are some specially gifted children out there, but I do believe it's very dangerous for a kid to be labeled unique and different than other kids. What we're talking about is regular kids, regular families, regular people who are sometimes dealing with something extraordinary or who want to go looking into this. And so, as with anything, when you're dealing with young children, parents have to be involved to give guidance. But if the kids are interested, we want at least want a resource out there that's backed by professionals, by, you know, at least someone with a PhD, and it's a starting point for families and for kids, because there's really nothing else out there.
And any other projects are coming up, although it sounds like that right there is enough to keep you busy for a good long time.
Yeah, no, that's just like everything with Ghost Village. It's, we've started it, and now it will grow and expand as we move forward. I've got two other kids' books I'm actually working on, which I'm excited about. Those will be, those probably won't be out till 2010, but, I've got, you know, two other projects there, and, I've got two paranormal books for adults that I can't get out of my head. I'm just trying to find the right time to sit down and get to them, and hopefully that will be in the winter and spring this year. So, and now that it's October, I've got a lot of lectures I'm doing, you know, going to be at some conferences, and those are always fun to do, to get out there and meet people. So there's always a lot cooking.
Well, Jeff Belanger, thank you for joining us tonight. Jeff is one of the foremost experts in America on the paranormal. In 1999, he launched the extremely popular and ever-growing GhostVillage.com. It's grown to become the largest paranormal community on the web. He has written many books, including Weird Massachusetts. He's written Ghost of War, Restless Spirit of Soldiers, Spies, and Saboteurs. We did a show on that. Encyclopedia of Haunted Places, and other important books. He's one of the leading lecturers on paranormal phenomenon. He's been a guest on numerous TV and radio programs. So, Jeff, thank you again for taking time out for the Little Old Paranormal Podcast.
Hey, anytime, Jim. Thanks for having me back.
And thank you for listening. I got to say something, guys. We appreciate all the great reviews on iTunes. It's really kind of pushed our profile up over there. And we thank so much for all the emails and so forth. Things are going great guns here at the Paranormal Podcast, and we're growing by leaps and bounds. We have a little ways to go before Halloween. And as I said, all during the month of October, we're going to be putting out about two shows a week. So keep your iTunes fired up and ready to download those new shows. And until next time, I'm Jim Harreld. You've been listening to the Paranormal Podcast. Good night.